Okay. Good afternoon. My name is Jelena Salmi, and I'm a third-year PhD student in the Department of History and Ethnology. My own background is in social and cultural anthropology, and geographically speaking, I'm focused on India, and more specifically, northern India. Today, I will talk about ethical challenges of fieldwork among persons with little or no education. So my topic is very specific. I will not address all the possible ethical challenges, but just some important issues that I have come across in my own ethnographic research. So the presentation is based on my own experiences of conducting fieldwork among illiterate or little educated people in two different locations in India. One of them is a rural setting, a group of villages located in the Bijolia district in southern Rajasthan. I stayed in Bijolia for 3 months in 2012. The other one is an urban area, more specifically a slum resettlement site in the city of Ahmedabad, the most populous city in the state of Gujarat. Here, I spent 11 months during the years 2015 and 2016. In the first location, Bijolia, I interviewed villagers about their perceptions and practices related to child marriage. And at that time, I was doing an internship in an Indian NGO, which was involved in empowerment of women through income generation and different kinds of capacity-building trainings. During my internship, I also collected data for my master's thesis on child marriage. I did more than 100 interviews with villagers, and I was always accompanied by a local member of that NGO that I was affiliated with. In the second location, Ahmedabad, I focused on consequences of development-induced displacement of slum dwellers. I did 62 interviews of displaced people and had hundreds of more informal discussions in the course of everyday participant observation. I did all the interviews on my own or with the help of a local man who lived in the slum resettlement site himself. So in Ahmedabad, my work was much more independent than it was in Bijolia. No one presented me to the people that I wanted to study, and I arranged most of the interviews on my own. However, in both of these locations, my research participants consisted mostly of people who were illiterate or little educated, often below the poverty line, and often low-caste Hindus, indigenous people, or Muslims. And it can be said that most of them were socially and economically in a disadvantaged position. I will now tell you a story that illustrates many of the ethical dilemmas involved in fieldwork among persons with little or no education. The story takes you a year back in time. So imagine that it's November 2015 and that you are here in a slum resettlement site in the city of Ahmedabad. You have been living next to this slum resettlement site for the past 8 months or so, and during this time you have already interviewed many residents of the area. The people whose life you're interested in used to live in city center slums about 12 kilometers from where you are now. They were displaced from their homes because the city of Ahmedabad aspires to be a slum-free world-class city. And in order to achieve this goal, urban poor have been removed from the city center and resettled in these kinds of concrete apartment blocks put up in the urban fringes. You are studying everyday life in one of these resettlement sites. You want to find out how people feel about their displacement, how they talk about the government that orchestrated the resettlement, and what they think about the new neighborhood and their new neighbors. In order to really understand life in the slum resettlement site, you have decided to rent an apartment just next to it. In this way, you are able to easily participate in residents' everyday life. Today has been an unusually hot day for November, about 37 degrees Celsius, and now around 5 p.m., weather is starting to be bearable, and you decide to go out for the day's second interview. You have already interviewed one person in the morning, but the interview wasn't very successful. The interviewee didn't have much time to dedicate to you because he had other things to do. He had to work. So at 5 p.m., you go out from your apartment and approach one of the buildings. You're on your way to meet a woman called Radwa, whom you have met before. Now you want to interview her. In fact, you have already agreed on the interview beforehand when you last met. You climb the stairs of one of the blocks to the second floor where Radwa's apartment is located. The door is open and you peek in. You see Radwa and ask her if now is a good time for the interview that you talked about. She says that she's on her way to her father's place, but come back another time. You feel a bit irritated, but what can you do? If she has to go, she has to go. Then you notice that there's another, older woman in the room. The woman is Radwa's neighbor, whom you have not met before. You have brought your recorder and your notebook, and you're very eager to conduct an interview since you are mentally prepared for that. You introduce yourself to the neighbor and ask her if she'd be interested in being interviewed. She looks doubtful. You gather that the woman has probably been interviewed before for all kinds of surveys that government officials, NGO workers, and other researchers have conducted among slum dwellers. "What will I get out of this?" she asks, sounding a bit hostile. You are not intimidated because you're already used to that question. In fact, you were anticipating it. You tell the woman that you don't represent the government or an NGO. You are a PhD student from Finland, Europe, and you are studying to get a degree. Moreover, you want to spread knowledge about what happened to people living in city center slums. You are going to write a book about it. You emphasize that you don't have the power to allot houses or arrange services to anyone. Then you continue by explaining what kinds of things you're interested in knowing. Day-to-day life in the resettlement site, available government services, relationships between neighbors. You also mention that you live just 500 meters from the woman's apartment. In fact, you have already lived there for months and you're not leaving before February next year. Now her expression changes from suspicion to worry. She says that she doesn't have anything to say. How could she know the correct answers to questions of a well-educated foreign student from the Philippines or wherever it was that you're from? Perhaps you're American. Being a bright young woman, Radwa realizes the problem and decides to help you. She explains to her neighbor that this foreign person is not looking for correct answers. She just wants to know everyone's individual opinions. "Everyone thinks differently, right?" she says to her neighbor. "You have different views about things than I do. This person wants to hear your opinions." You feel relieved. You tell the woman that her involvement in research will cause no harm to her, and that you will not use her real name in your book. You continue that if she doesn't want to answer to some questions, She can just say that, "I don't want to talk about that subject." You will not force her into anything. The woman smiles, gets up, and tells you to follow her to her flat. This occasion certainly calls for some chai and biscuits. First chai, then interview. You are humbled by her generosity, although you have already drunk 4 chais and eaten some roti breads, some spicy vegetable gravy, a couple of fruits, and a lot of biscuits while doing fieldwork that day. But the last thing you want to do is to offend your interviewee. And let's face it, your situation could be much worse than having to drink 5 delicious chais a day while talking to interesting people. Okay, so there were several ethical challenges involved in the situation that I just described. And this presentation will focus on the following 3 challenges. Firstly, what constitutes informed consent when interviewing people with little or no education? This is the most important point of my talk. Secondly, how to deal with misconceptions about your intentions and the aim of your study. It is very common for people to have misconceptions, especially if you are conducting research outside your home country and or among non-educated people. Thirdly, should researchers give something back to interviewees that are in a disadvantaged position? Giving gifts is a topic that already sparked a lot of discussion, and I'll continue on that. Now I must admit that I don't have answers to these questions. This presentation is unable to give clear-cut solutions simply because there are no absolute rules. However, we do have ethical principles and guidelines articulated by the Finnish Advisory Board on Research Integrity, as well as several field-specific professional organizations, such as the American Anthropological Association, which Laura already mentioned, and the International Sociological Association. Here you can see an extract of the ISA's Code of Ethics as an example. In the introduction, it is written that the Code of Ethics is not exhaustive, all-embracing, and rigid. So while every researcher should be well familiar with the field-specific ethical guidelines, the application of these guidelines is not that simple in practice. Nevertheless, I believe that sharing experiences and discussing ethical dilemmas involved in ethnographic research can build up our ethical mindfulness, so to speak. Perhaps more so than just going through various guidelines independently. And ethical dilemmas are certainly abound in fieldwork among little educated people. The purpose of my presentation will be to challenge you to reflect on these dilemmas, not to provide instructions set in stone. So feel free to comment, to ask questions, and especially to share your own experiences, since I'm in the process of learning myself and also hope to learn from you. So I'll start with the first challenge, which is informed consent, one of the cornerstones of research ethics. According to Hammersley and Atkinson, informed consent means that research participants should be given enough information about research goals, funding sources, as well as possible outcomes and impacts for them to know what their participation involves. Facts must be presented in a form understandable to potential participants. Researcher must obtain the voluntary and informed consent of participants beforehand. In the case of an interview, consent must be obtained before the interview starts. Participants must also be able to withdraw from the study anytime they wish to do so. So obtaining consent is a continuing negotiation with research participants throughout the project. Consent forms and verbal agreements. Sometimes consent forms are used to secure informed consent. Consent forms are written documents that research participants read and sign. And these forms usually include the objective of the research, the approximate duration of the interview, the number of interviewees, mention about the tape recorder, and the right to end the interview at any time. By signing the document, the interviewee lets the researcher know that he or she has understood what participation in the research involves. But what if the interviewees are illiterate? Does it make any sense to ask them to sign something that they cannot read? Well, naturally it doesn't. It's completely pointless. And actually, I think that it would be rather unethical. But consent doesn't necessarily have to be a written signed document. A verbal agreement between the interviewer and the interviewee is sufficient. But how then to make sure that people really understand what their participation involves? How to secure verbal informed consent when interviewing little educated or illiterate people? Personally, I found this to be very difficult, and I have to admit that I wasn't always 100% sure. Anyway, I will now talk about some things to consider in the process of trying to secure informed consent. First one is the choice of concepts. This was something that I had to think about a lot, both in Bijolia and in Ahmedabad. The major problem was that most of my interviewees did not understand what the word research means. They knew about universities, that universities are places of higher education, but they were not familiar with the research function of universities. The word research, both in Hindi, anusandhan or khoj, and in English, was an empty signifier. People were, however, familiar with the word survey, but the problem with survey was that the word carried a connotation of surveillance or control imposed on them. For example, people's houses in slums had been surveyed before they were demolished. So surveys were seen as a negative thing, but they were also seen as a possibility to access resources. If you answer to survey questions in a certain way, you may be able to access some benefits. So, if I use the word survey without further explanations, people thought that their participation in my research would somehow directly affect them, either positively or negatively. After realizing these problems, I discarded the word research because it didn't mean anything. Instead, I said that I am a university student studying to get a degree and that I am doing a survey for a personal book project. I wanted to retain the word survey because through it people instantly realized that I want to ask questions and I want them to answer these questions. So they knew that what the social interaction would be like. However, I had to make it very clear that even though I'm doing a survey, I am not a government official. I explained that I am interested in gaining knowledge and that I will write a book on the basis of the interviews. The Indian government is not paying me to do it, nor is the Finnish government. I get money from a university in my home country. Explaining possible consequences realistically. In Ahmedabad, I explained that my book will spread information about the situation in the slum resettlement site, but it will not directly bring any benefits to my interviewees. I said that I do not have the power to make any decisions concerning their future, but my book will be available for anyone, including government officials, to read. Hence, it's possible that the information written in the book can be used for interviewees' benefit, but I cannot make any promises. In the end, no one refused to give an interview on the grounds that it would not benefit them in any way. Through this explanation, my interviewees also understood that I would personally benefit from the interviews in the form of getting a degree. They realized that it was them who were helping me perhaps more than I was helping them, which was something new. This put us on a more equal level, and I felt that it relaxed the atmosphere a lot. Because without this explanation, some people thought that I would be able to arrange them large sums of money from abroad or something like that. And then they tried to please me. In the course of my fieldwork, I constantly had to remind them of my own powerlessness, emphasizing the fact that I'm just a student helped to some extent, but I will return to this point later. Next thing is explaining what your research is about. As Hammersley and Atkinson point out, ethnographers rarely tell all the people they are studying everything about the research. One reason for this is that in the beginning, research focus is often not very clear. And this was the case with my research. I couldn't tell my interviewees exactly what the research was about because I didn't even know it myself. The amount of information given varied from one person to another, the lastly interviewed people being more informed. And there were also differences in people's interest towards my research. Some people were not that interested to know all the details, and of course I didn't want to burden them that you have to listen to this so that it makes my research ethical. I think that it's not ethical to force them to listen to something which they find completely uninteresting. But if someone showed more interest, I did naturally then give more information and answered their questions. Next point is social and cultural factors. For example, the conception of personhood and individual autonomy. It can be said that in Finland, we are quite individualistic and conceptualize subjects as distinct from other people. Each person is in charge of his or her own mind and body. But this may not be the case everywhere in the world. In fact, it can be argued that in India, persons are more relational than they are in Finland. And this doesn't mean that Indian people don't have any agency, but simply that membership in a community and family relations play a bigger part in India than they do in Finland. This, in my view, needs to be acknowledged when eliciting informed consent. The different conceptions of personhood and personal autonomy became apparent when I was trying to arrange interviews with women. Some female interviewees of mine were hesitant to answer my questions before talking to their husbands, especially in the villages of Bijolia. In some cases, husband's permission or even husband's presence was required to secure informed consent if we look at the personhood in a relational way. And I, of course, had to respect their wishes. Some women also thought that interviewing their husband is the same thing as interviewing them. Like husband and wife form a unit and share all the opinions, so what's the point in interviewing them individually? So, in sum, one needs to ask, who is the culturally appropriate person to provide consent? Sometimes family members or community leaders have to be consulted, and interviewing a person without the consent of these important people might even be harmful for the interviewee. So I'd say that this issue is probably more pronounced in fieldwork among people that are illiterate or less educated, and especially in village environments. But I don't want to make any generalizations. That's just a feeling that I have. The last but not least on this list is to record or not to record. In Ahmedabad, I used a recorder and asked permission to record all the interviews. But I always had to ask that, do the interviewers really understand what a recorder is and why am I using it? Most of my interviewees had a mobile phone, and some of them thought that the recorder is just some kind of a phone. Others knew instantly that it's a device that records your voice. I often showed my interviewees in practice how recording is done and let them listen to a recording. And this was easy to do, of course, but it was more difficult to make them understand why I wanted to record their voices. People were sometimes suspicious, and I had to explain that recording is important so that I'll be able to write down their answers correctly. So I made it clear that as soon as the interview is finished, I will listen to the tape and write down everything that people told me, and that the tape will only be used for the purposes of my book. I thought that it would be too complicated to explain that, yeah, I will store the data electronically here, and then other researchers can later go back to it after 30 years and use it. So I decided that I'm not going to store it anywhere. I don't know if it's the right thing to do, since I just heard that about the data management plan. But too late now. I also explained that if I just take notes, some information may be left unnoted, and I won't be able to remember everything correctly after the interview. And usually people were satisfied with this explanation, and they even made sure that, is everything that I said now on that tape, and make sure that you write it exactly as I told you. That being said, there are differing views on whether or not it is ethical to record in situations where interviewees are little educated or unfamiliar with modern technology. One cannot be 100% sure that participants are fully informed. I know that some researchers have chosen not to record their interviews due to ethical reasons. And the reason why I wanted to do that was that I did most of my interviews on my own. I didn't have an interpreter. My interviewee's native language was either Gujarati or Hindi, and since I speak Hindi, I was able to manage without an interpreter. However, I wanted to have the recording to check and correct misunderstandings that I may have had in the interview situation. I was also as interested in language use as I was in the content of the interview. So I felt that I need the tape to better analyze, for example, people's choice of words in certain contexts. The third reason for using a recorder had to do with note-taking. I soon realized that people were actually more influenced by my note-taking than by the recorder. So if I wrote down everything that they said in the interview situation, then they started looking that, what are you doing? Why are you writing that down? And that don't do that. So using the recorder, I didn't have to make so many notes, and I could concentrate on the interview better. And it was also less intimidating for the interviewees and easier for me. However, in Bijolia, I didn't use a recorder. I didn't speak the local dialect, although I could understand some of it. There, I had to use an interpreter, but I couldn't be completely sure that she actually translated everything that I said correctly. So there were more question marks than in Ahmedabad, and the subject was sensitive since child marriage is illegal. And so I felt that recording wasn't the right thing to do. But our ethical challenges related to recording do not end here. There's also the question of where to keep the recorder. I usually placed it in between my interviewee and me so that both of us could see it. In multi-person discussions, it was a bit more tricky because new people arrived during the interview and others left. In those cases, I explained about the recorder once in the beginning, and after that, only if someone asked what the recorder was, and also if there was some person who seemed to be suspicious. But it all depended on the context. And now a few words about misconceptions regarding your intentions. Misconceptions are related to informed consent, and I already mentioned that it's essential to clearly explain what you will personally get out of the research. However, in my experience, misconceptions are particularly common in ethnographic research among illiterate or little educated people, and I therefore chose to dedicate more time to it. In ethnographic research, the researcher often conducts not only interviews, but also participant observation. Ethnographers spend time among people that they are studying and observe various social situations in the field. Thus, it's very likely that you'll meet new people every day, and you must be prepared to constantly explain yourself. Who are you? Why are you here? Where are you from? What are you doing? Who pays you to do this? People will have misconceptions about who you are and what your intentions are. This can be nerve-wracking, but you should politely and patiently correct these misunderstandings time after time. I'll give you a few examples from Ahmedabad. Residents of the slum resettlement site that I was working in often thought that being foreign, I have more power than I actually do. Some people even accused me of being Obama's spy or of trying to make India look bad in the USA. Others thought that I was working for the Indian government and that I had the power to allot apartments for them because many of them wanted to move out of the slum resettlement site into other parts of the city. Still others thought that I held some high-ranking office in Europe and that I could easily arrange meetings with the Prime Minister, Narendra Modi. And these misconceptions were something that I constantly had to deal with, and it took a lot of patience, but became easier as I got to know more people over the months. So this was the case in Ahmedabad. In villages, the situation was a bit different, because I did my interviews together with a local NGO worker, who was also my translator. People had positive attitude towards the NGO because it gave microloans to women and supported children's schooling. And I have to say that without the local contact, it would have been impossible to study child marriage in that setting. No one would have agreed to talk to me. However, being accompanied by an NGO worker also caused a lot of misunderstandings about my role, because I was also naturally considered an NGO worker, and I got the feeling that people thought that they have to give an interview to me in order to access microloans. And this was something that I needed to explain before each interview. I said that I'm working with the NGO, but the information is also used for my personal project, and that people have the right to refuse. Refusing won't have any effect. Moreover, I had to explain to some interviewees that I will not inform the police about illegal practices because sometimes people had ideas about me being a police officer who tried to get them arrested for practicing child marriage. It's not, however, always wise to tell everything about your research to everyone that you meet, and especially if your research subject is politically sensitive or deals with illegal practices. It can be ethical towards yourself and your research participants to sometimes not correct misconceptions and to conceal information, even lie. I will next tell you an example. In the blurry background photo, my husband and I are posing in Ahmedabad with local politicians during municipal elections. On the right-hand side, there are two men belonging to the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party, and on the left-hand side, there's a man belonging to the rival party, the Indian National Congress Party. And these politicians are not my interviewees. My research subject is politically quite sensitive because in the official discourse, slum resettlement has been a great success, and this fact should not be questioned. Government officials don't want foreign researchers or even worse, journalists snooping around in the resettlement sites. However, due to me being a young female, officials often thought that I must be completely harmless and innocent, and I don't understand much about anything. And I didn't correct them. I was actually happy with this misconception. And one of these three politicians even took us around in his car, showing us people's voting behavior during the elections. And I even got to see one of the voting booths from the inside because I was accompanied by this politician who could just walk past all the guards and people standing in the line. So this way I got access to information that otherwise would have been out of my reach. The only thing that these men knew about me was that I was a foreign student studying housing in India. So perhaps one could say that I engaged in active deception. I didn't give these men thorough information about my research subject and my role. And is it ethical? Well, perhaps not. Not towards them, at least. However, I felt that while concealing information was not ethical towards them, it was ethical towards myself and my research participants, because these men had the power to make my life and my research participants' life difficult had they known what I was actually doing and that I was interviewing the people whom I'm not supposed to talk to. So in my view, concealing information was the right thing to do in this situation. If you look at the bigger picture, my first obligation was to protect my research participants from harm and to advance my research. But of course, some people may think differently about this issue. This brings us to the question, ethical responsibility towards whom? There can be conflicting obligations, and you also have to remember your ethical obligations towards yourself and towards other researchers. Revealing too much information to certain people may make it difficult for other researchers to do their work in the same site. Research should be conducted in a way that research participants do not refuse access in the future. And this is an ethical responsibility towards colleagues so that ethnographic research can continue in the future. So I'd say that if your research task is politically sensitive, you need to carefully think about what kind of information you want to share and with whom you share it. I learned this the hard way, because when I was conducting research on child marriage in Bijolia, I spoke too much to some people in an internet cafe because I naively thought that no one cares what a random student is doing there. But it was a mistake. A local journalist, who was also an active member of the right-wing Hindu nationalist organization called the Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, took interest in what I was up to. And this caused some trouble to the Indian NGO that I was working with. And after that, the founder of the NGO told me not to share any information about my research with anyone that I was not interviewing, as this could jeopardize their work in that area. I was directed to lie that I'm there to just study Hindi and teach English to children. So while I had to lie to some people, concealing information was ethical towards the NGO that I was affiliated with, and it also protected my interviewees. The third and the last issue of this presentation is whether researchers should give something back to research participants that are in a disadvantaged position. In their book Ethnography, Hammersley and Atkinson mention that it is sometimes claimed that research involves the exploitation of those studied, that people supply the information which is used by the researcher and yet get little or nothing in return. Anthropologists often, but by no means always, study people who are less powerful than themselves. And it can be said that we get more than we give. Therefore, recommendations have been made that researchers should give something back, whether it be empowerment that follows from participation, or services, or payment, or even money. But these don't always avoid the problem. They can, in fact, create problems. I paid my research assistant a monthly salary equivalent to what he would be getting if working in a clothing shop, like many people belonging to his caste did. I paid him because I thought that he couldn't get another job while he was working with me. But I didn't give money to other research participants, and there were three reasons for this. First one was that I thought that it might affect the information that they are giving me. They might give answers that they think that I'm looking for. And they could try to please me. But as Laura rightly mentioned, how do they know what I'm looking for? Second reason was that I knew that if I gave money, the word would spread and people would start following me, asking me to interview them. And I didn't want to interview every single person in the resettlement site because there were, I think, about 4,000 people. I wanted to choose some people so that I had a sample that well represented the whole area or the population of the area. Had I offered money, people would have asked me to interview them instead of me asking for an interview. And it would have been hard to explain why I didn't want to interview and give money or some other things to everyone. Third, and the most important reason was that I felt that offering money could have been insulting. I tried to establish equal relationships with my interviewees, and offering money would have put us in an unequal position. Last week, I discussed this subject over lunch with colleagues Jukka and Shimi, and Shimi posed the question, would you offer money to middle-class interviewees? Which I think is a very relevant question, because you probably wouldn't do that. It could be considered condescending. But why then offer money to poor people? I don't want to claim that offering money is always a bad idea. It can be justifiable in some situations. For example, if interviews are very long, they take the whole day and people lose their day's earnings. But I still felt that it would have brought more problems than benefits in my case. And besides, I did my interviews in times that people could still work, or then we stopped earlier so that they could go to work. Instead of money, in Ahmedabad, I gave some of my research participants photographs of themselves. And this was something that they requested. The initiative, that it didn't come from me. I usually had a camera with me, and many people wanted to be photographed. They didn't have any photos of themselves except for the wedding photos. And so what I did was that I took a photo of an interviewee, developed the photo, and then returned to give the photo back to him or her. The background photo depicts one of my interviewees 18 years ago when she got married. This woman had just this one photo of herself, and it was quite dirty and torn out. So she asked me to take a photo of the photo and give it to her. And of course, I agreed to do that. Sometimes I also took photos of living conditions in the slum resettlement site and gave the photos to people who were active in submitting complaints about the lack of municipal services. They said that they'd use these photos to point out the problems to municipal officers. Once I also wrote a couple of complaints in English on behalf of two groups of people, and they then took those complaints to a municipal office. Moreover, when I left Ahmedabad, I gave my household things, such as an air cooler, a spring mattress, an electric water boiler, kitchen utensils, curtains, and so on, to some of my key informants. While some people were very happy to receive these gifts, others did not want to accept expensive gifts. For example, one woman to whom I gave the mattress, which was quite expensive, said that, "I'm only looking after this mattress for you, so when you come back, you can come and collect it. Like, I will use it, but it's not mine." So in this way, she refused to take the role of a person in need of assistance and also expressed a wish for our relationship to continue. And I interpreted her reluctance as a statement that she wanted to be treated as an equal. I'm not sure if that's what she meant, but so I felt. And I'd say that perhaps being treated as an equal can also be considered as giving something back. Treating people in a respectful way and paying attention to their feelings and experiences are, or at least should be, self-evident in ethnographic research. But research participants that are in a marginalized position may not consider it self-evident. And this feeling of being respected and being heard can actually be more important than getting money or even this great expensive mattress. And finally, a few words about representation and the usefulness of research beyond the academia. Our ethical responsibilities towards the people that we are studying do not end at the moment when we leave the field site. Researchers have to be mindful of research ethics also in the writing process. It's not insignificant how we write about our research participants, how we present their experiences and make them meaningful to wider audiences. I agree with Arthur Bochner in his statement that what researchers write should be written for participants as much as about them. Researchers and participants should be accountable to each other. Researchers' voices should not dominate the voices of participants. In my view, what ethnographers write should not stay in the hands of a few academics. Instead, we should spread knowledge outside the glossy conference rooms of universities. I see it as an ethical responsibility towards research participants to try and reach wider audiences for the produced knowledge, not forgetting the research participants themselves. And language plays a big part in this effort. how to write in a way that is easy to understand outside the academic world. Moreover, how to make this information accessible to participants that are illiterate or otherwise don't possess the required language skills. Again, I don't have a definite answer. I can only speak for myself. But when it comes to my research, I'm planning to send a few copies of my dissertation, which is still in progress, by the way, to the people that I interviewed, even though most of them will not be able to read it without help, at least. But they'll still get to see the physical end result, the book that I was talking about. So they knew that I didn't lie. And also some of them have acquaintances that speak English, so I'm hoping that those people can translate them, at least parts of the text. And possibly I'll also be able to visit the area myself and bring the book myself. But this is not all. I have also done an ethnographic film, which I will present to the people that I interviewed, as well as some other people who took a part in my research some way or another. And this film is much more accessible than the English language dissertation, like we already talked about, the use of visual media. Actually, I'm going to Ahmedabad on Sunday this week, and my plan is to show the film to some people who participated in my research, and I'm hoping that through the film we'll be able to discuss how I'm representing the slum resettlement site and its residents and what they think about my representation. I also believe that their comments about the film will not only enable me to do a more ethical film, but they will also guide me towards a more ethical way and a more respectful way of representing these people in the form of writing. I will stop here. Still have 5 minutes, right? For if you have any questions or comments.
Okay, thank you very much, Yelena, for an interesting presentation. Any questions or comments, please? Yes, I see some reaction there.
This is just a comment to agitate and tease out more questions. So thank you for your presentation. I think it's really, really good work you are doing. And for somebody from a third world country, I think these are some of the kinds of studies we appreciate in that sense, because it tackles reality in existence. I think I just want to say the last comment you made is quite important about how to represent and then how to write our studies in languages that are understood outside the fine walls of the universities. Research communication is something that is missing. And most we have very good studies, but they don't translate outside the field. And I've had experience like that. So your comment, the last statement you made, resounds with me very much. I go for an interview, and a highly educated person asks me, what do we gain from these studies? They just end up on the shelves. And it hit me a lot, because I thought I've been wasting my time all this while if all my studies don't have an impact in society. So I think that the ability to write our studies in such a way that can be understood by policymakers in a very simple way, like the film you are coming up out with, is quite commendable. I think you are doing well. I wish I could replicate your
method. Thank you very much for your comment. Yeah, I think that I've always wondered that why is there not more courses on writing in undergraduate studies, because when I was studying, I think we didn't have any courses about that. So it would be a good thing to start practicing it already when you're doing your bachelor's degree, how to write different kinds of text and to different audiences.
I would just like to thank you too for a very interesting presentation, and you've come up with some very ingenious ways of trying to involve the community where you are doing your study and show them the relevance of it and what you have been doing, and I think that's really great.
Thank you very much.
Any other questions or comments? Just a minute.
Thank you for a very eloquent presentation, very interesting work. In terms of spreading knowledge outside the academic field, in my field, which is, therapy research, music therapy research, so we have all these studies with participants, and then we publish articles, you know, about the results. And typically what happens, if we're lucky, is that a journalist will pick up on that article and write a journalistic article in the press, you know, and so that's our main way of accessing a larger public. Unfortunately, you probably know about that. These articles often don't represent properly the research, actually. So then we are stuck with, okay, so it is spread, but it's distorted. It's not correct. People get the wrong idea. So I don't have the answer to the problem of reaching more people, but I don't know in ethnology how much exposure you have to mass media and to journalists, but in my field, but I mean, even if you had more, it's not a panacea either, you know. It doesn't solve the problem of reaching more people accurately, or so I don't know. I just wanted to say that.
Well, our research center has a blog which Jukka has put up, and I think that's a very good start to try and reach wider audiences, because it's not that the language is easier to understand, in my view, and they are shorter blog texts, easy to start into these subjects. So I think that's a brilliant idea to have research blogs.
Any other questions or comments?
Thank you for your very interesting presentation. I'm thinking, is this India somehow popular research target at the moment? Because there is also in the sign language research area, ethnographic research, and she has actually also collected data for an ethnographic film. Annelise Kosters is also working in India. And that film that she has made is found in YouTube, if you just want to check it. It has to do with the facial expressions of sign language users in India. So just for your information.
Thank you. What was the name of the researcher?
Annelise Kosters.
Okay. Annelise Kosters. Thank you for the recommendation.
Do you have any comment on the popularity of India as a research topic?
It seems to be quite popular in our university's ethnology discipline, at least at the moment. But I don't know what's the reason behind it. Perhaps the fact that India is urbanizing in such a rapid phase, so a lot of most of the people who are working on India in our department are focused on that issue, the urbanization and the rise of mobile technology, things like that. So maybe it's the scale and pace of urbanization that also attracts researchers to focus on India.
Any other questions or comments? Okay, if not, thank you, Jelena, again. And next we will have Kirsi-Maria Hyttönen.
Thank you.
paikaltiin. Laitoilla varmuuden vuoksi sähköposti, että tulee paniikki, ne varaidaan sen sieltä. Esitelmiä marraskuussa.
Good afternoon, everyone. Please let me know if you can't hear me. Thank you, Yelena, for your presentation. It was striking for me to hear how many similarities there are in between our research projects. And now maybe my turn is to tell that you don't have to go all the way to India to make research with people with less education and with in somewhat vulnerable position compared to yourself. But we have faced similar problems like with Yelena, like how to explain what your research is about for people who really, really don't know what university research is and how it is done and how it's funded and how the research material will be used later. And also these questions about researchers' responsibilities toward participants are really difficult and important. On this part of today, I don't think I need to tell you anymore what research ethics is about. In my presentation, I will focus on one case study, and through that, I will talk about research ethics in a research project that handles so-called sensitive topics. When a topic is sensitive, it often makes informants vulnerable, and therefore interviews and fieldwork are not easy to conduct, or at least you have to ponder the ethical questions really carefully. Often these informants are not vulnerable only mentally, but also socially and physically, and therefore researchers should always put special attention on ethics and make sure that no any kind of harm is done for the informants. To not cause any harm or any trouble for participants, research participants, is the most important part of research ethics, at least I think so. However, my claim today is that a good, balanced research project needs more than that. Research ethics must be considered also from the viewpoint of usage of the material as well as from the viewpoint of researcher. Not to mention all the other aspects of research ethics, like, for example, respective attitude towards informants, contextualization, how to contextualize the material in fair and just way, understanding the role and responsibilities of a researcher, carrying responsibility of the results of the research and consequences that your research might cause, and make just and fair references, not to steal anyone else's ideas. I think Laura mentioned this already in the morning. But these are very important parts of research ethics too. But today I will focus on a little bit different part of ethics. The research project that I will present you in a minute is not actually, I haven't actually done ethnographic field work, but I'm oral historian. And that makes a little bit different viewpoint on the things. But however, I think there's lots of similarities in questions of ethics. I will set questions: how should research ethics take into consideration when both the topic of research and research participants are fragile and vulnerable? And what does it actually mean that a research topic is sensitive or difficult? I'm going to view these research questions of research ethics on each phase of the project. So before the research project starts, or you can actually look at them with each interview, as I said, so before an interview or the whole project starts, during the interview or during in the middle of the project, and thirdly, after the project ends. And I will look at all these phases from three different viewpoints, from viewpoints of interviewees or research participants, from the viewpoint of research material and how to use it, and thirdly, from the viewpoint of researchers. I'm talking on very practical level, and giving examples what kind of questions we had to solve in our project, and very practical tips how we solve them. Things that I say today might seem too detailed or extravagant, or that you might think that I'm exaggerating risks, ethical risks. But to be honest, in this project where I worked, I don't think we exaggerated at all. I think all these risks that I'm presenting you were actually true and real. The case study that I'm talking about, the project that I'm talking about, is historical inquiry on child abuse and neglect in child protection institutions and foster homes in Finland from 1930s to the early 1980s. It was commissioned by the Finnish Ministry of Social Affairs and Health, and ministry didn't actually invent the idea of this kind of inquiry by themselves. But the background is that there's international trend to do these inquiries. It's been done before Finland. It was done in all Nordic countries, in many Western European countries, in Australia and in Canada, etc. And in many countries, there's been lots of discussions after these inquiries. There's been political actions and open public apologies and even financial compensations for the victims. All these inquiries, international in different countries, as well as this Finnish one that we made, they have all revealed abuse and neglect and really harsh violence towards children in out-of-home care. These inquiries are different in different countries. For example, in some countries they are focused on institutions by Catholic Church, or maybe only to children's homes, or maybe they are just making these inquiries one children's home by time. But in Finland we followed the model from Sweden, and we included all forms of out-of-home care, meaning children's homes, reformatory schools, and foster families, and all forms of abuse and neglect, meaning emotional violence, physical violence, and sexual violence, and then all sorts of abuse and neglect, all the other forms of abuse and neglect. Special attention was paid on research ethics, and we really pondered these questions a lot. The aim of the project was set up by the ministry, and there were three different aims. First one was to produce information about mistreatment or maltreatment of children in out-of-home care, because we don't really know much about that. We know that it occurred, but we don't know how and where and why and what kind. And the second aim was to recognize this phenomena, just to kind of finally admit that when the state was supposed to protect children that were taken from their biological homes, that the state actually failed in many cases and caused only trouble for these kids in the past. And the third, and I think very important aim and task of the inquiry was to gather knowledge from the history so that we could learn from the past and to improve our current social security, our current child protection systems, and to make sure that no other child would ever be neglected or abused again. It might be utopia, but that was the aim, to develop our current systems. We collected about 300 life story interviews, with mainly with victims of abuse and neglect, but also with some eyewitnesses, so with me, which means people who had worked in institutions, or maybe like biological brothers, brothers or sisters in the foster families or something like that, but mainly they were workers in institutions, these eyewitnesses. There was about 300 interviews. Each of the interviews lasted about one hour to five hours. Some of them, they were very long, but approximately 1.5 hours each. These interviews were recorded, transcribed, and they will be archived in the Finnish Social Science Data Archive in Tampere. But the archiving process is still in the process, but they will be there. The final report of the inquiry was published because this was state's project, so there was no book or actual research. It was a report that we wrote, and it was published last April when the project ended. And it's publicly available in the internet. In Finnish, recently it was translated to Swedish too. So what makes this kind of topic sensitive and fragile? Why is this a sensitive topic? Why are these people who we interviewed, why are they fragile, and why I say that they are vulnerable? Childhood in out-of-home care used to be, and unfortunately still is, a topic that people don't want to talk about. It's shamed, there's lots of silence considering the topic still in our society. People who have been taken from their biological home to live in child welfare institution or in foster families, they often feel themselves to be like lower class people. They are they are made to believe that they are not as good as the rest of the people for some reason. There's a lot of structural violence in our society, in our welfare society, and lots of these people have really faced lots of trouble and prejudice in their adulthood because of their background, that they have lived in foster families or in child welfare institutions. Abuse and neglect, it often includes different sorts of humiliation and humiliative experiences which support this silence. You don't want to talk about experiences where you are being humiliated. And not only out of home care, but in other fields of society too, maltreatment or abuse of children is actually not very, nice topic to talk about. So it's a difficult topic to talk about even in other ways, and not to mention this out of home care context. Also, it is difficult and it makes people vulnerable because talking about these memories was really, for some of them, it was really, really difficult. And they were not used to talk about it. For some, we were the first ones they ever talked about their childhood. They hadn't talked about their families, even to their husbands or children, or husbands or wives or children, about their experiences in childhood. And talking about this really difficult topic often, very, very often, reactivated the trauma, and it was these interviews were really emotional experiences for both for them and for us. these people have been neglected in their childhood by the society, and it often has kind of continued in their adulthood. They were victims of many forms of abuse and neglect, I could say, even today. And they rarely were people with higher education or with good income or anything. They were really people with lots of many sorts of difficulties in their life. So we had no reason to add their difficulties, and we had to be careful when we were making the research. So, as I promised, I will go through each phase of the project, and we will start from the beginning. Before we start a project with very sensitive topic, or before we start an each interview, we have to think to carefully certain things. First, in case of a sensitive topic, participation must always be voluntary. We didn't contact any of the informants. We didn't take student lists of reformatory schools and to trace people who had lived there. Instead, we publicly announced, and ministry publicly announced, that we are collecting these memories, and whoever wants to can contact us and participate on the project. And I think this was very important because it was so difficult for them to talk about it, so it was important that it was a decision made by themselves if they wanted to tell anyone that they had this background in out-of-home care. Interviewees, we underlined them that they have a right to withdraw from the project at any phase. They can stop in the middle of an interview and say that I don't want to continue and I don't want to participate and please delete my interview, and that we would totally respect that. Quite many of the interviewees cancelled their participation before the interview. With some, we had already set the date, we were going there, we had a meeting set and everything, but only like day before or something, they decided that they cannot participate, they are not able to talk about it, and they don't want to be here, want to be part of the project. And that was totally okay. But there were tens of them, so we really had to be prepared for that too. We gave them all the possible information about the aims of the project, ethics, how we are considering ethics, all the practicalities, rights of the informants, rights of the interviewees, etc. They were given by phone, they were in the internet, they were in the ministry's page, on the web page of the project at the university. When they contacted our coordinator, who answered the phone, she told about these things. We told about these things for the people when we first met them before the interview started, and we gave them 3 pages long written information sheet before we started, and they read about it after we had left. Still, I think Yelena talked about this too, misconceptions and misunderstandings were likely. One can never be sure, really, really sure, that people you are interviewing or research participants, that they really know what they actually participate. They can really, it's difficult to make sure that they understand what the tapes or interviews are, that they are going to go to archive and that they could be used for research later. And in our case study, or in this case study, I think many of the informants really didn't know what kind of emotions that these interviews could rise in there, or the stress that the interview caused. Many of them were surprised that they started to cry during the interview, or that they couldn't continue, they needed breaks. And they said that, oh, I didn't see this coming. As I said, most of the participants had quite little education. For them, we coming from the university meant something exciting, and they were pretty nervous to meet us. So many of them said when we were leaving, they said that, oh, you were just normal people. How it's so nice to see that you were just normal people, even though you are coming from the university. They were nervous of meeting us. Some of them wanted to address us formally, like with V form. One old lady was quite angry for me, and my colleague later, when I called her a few weeks after an interview, and she had read from the information sheet that we're both PhDs, and she was a little angry to me that you didn't tell that you were PhD. I could have dressed more formally and talked to you more formally if I knew. And I was like, well, oh, sorry, sorry, I didn't want it to matter, of course. If an informant, we're always told that if some informant or interviewee wants to close the recorder during the interview, we will do that, of course. All, of course, in the middle of an interview, and some wanted. They said that, please shut that down now. I want to say something that I don't want to be taped, and so on. In this case, it was especially important for the ministry that these informants had a possibility to give their interview on their mother tongue, because in Finland there's two official languages, so you have to be able to talk your mother tongue in official situations. And therefore, we had two researchers from Åbo Academy who were speaking Swedish as their mother tongue, and they made interviews in Swedish. Also, which was turned out to be quite important, when these participants called for our coordinator that they want to participate, she asked them, well, not directly, but made a point that is it okay that there could come like a male and female researcher. This was especially important when she knew that there would be a narrative about or memories about sexual abuse, because many women felt really difficult to trust on male interviewer or didn't want to talk about such a sensitive topic for a male interviewer. And so we offered them a chance to say that please send two women if they wanted to. Only once this was... we didn't succeed, so that when I was calling for the... We were on our way. I was going with my colleague Pekka, a male colleague, and we were driving to the participant's home, and I called that we are coming, and I said that me and Pekka, we are coming. And she said, what? Pekka, there's a man. I'm sorry, but no man is going to come across the... come through my door. She was so hardly sexual... so... roughly sexually abused in her childhood that she didn't want any man in her house anymore. So I went alone. But that was okay. Anyway, the interviewee should always know that the interview is going to be done in his or her terms, and the interviewer is there just to ask a few questions and hold the recorder, but it was interviewees. We were doing the interviews on their terms. Before the research starts, when we are thinking about the material and later usage of the material, it's very important that all informants must know that their interviews are recorded, and that these recordings are going to be in archive. If they give their consent, they will go to an archive and they will be later used in the research. As I said, we couldn't be sure that they all knew what it meant, that it will be archived, but they all signed a consent form. No one denied. there were two consent forms. One was signed by a researcher and given for the informant, and the other one was signed by a researcher and the informant, and it was filed in our archive here. But we made some interviews also via phone, or a few with Skype too. For some reason, Ministry of Social Affairs and Health didn't want to finance our field work in Thailand. We were a little sorry for that, but one person living in Thailand wanted to participate, so we had a Skype conversation with him. But how can you sign a consent form via telephone or Skype? Well, you can't. But in these cases, we recorded the discussion where the participant said that he's aware of the things, ethical things, and it's okay. Everything is okay. So it was kind of like oral sign. Also, thing that is very important is that these rules of anonymization of the material must be discussed beforehand. We didn't talk about the details of anonymization beforehand, and now we are faced a little bit troubles because we have promised for the informants one thing, and now our archive might have a different rules. But we have promised something for the informants, and we have to keep that promise. So that's why the material is not yet in the archive. Things will be okay. We will get an agreement. Rules of anonymization must be identical when we are talking to an archive and for the informants. And this is a detail that we didn't think about beforehand. But if I would be doing this again, I would definitely think about this before starting the first interview. We have to contact the archive early enough. Well, from the viewpoint of researcher, before any project starts, you have to think quite many things. Firstly, to follow, I think this is basic thing, and I think Laura said it already in the morning, to follow research ethics is part of our job. We are researchers. We cannot break the rules. I think this should be self-evident, but for our surprise, it's not. There's more and more plagiarism and stealing ideas and everything in university, in academy. So I think that's why I wanted to point out. In Finland, we are bound by rules of Finnish Advisory Board of Research Integrity. DENK, you can find the text from their webpage. And in the University of Jyväskylä, we have this ethical committee that Laura was talking about. Though we don't sign any form about when we start our research, there's no like contract between us and any of these boards or committees. But it's still part of our profession. And I think we sometimes forget to tell this for students that there are actually things you have to, even you don't sign a contract about research ethics, it's part of your profession. But in addition to these, from the researcher's viewpoint, there's ethical things you have to consider before you go to make the first interview. Firstly, and this is different from very many other academic projects that we do here at the university, we had to really think about the safety of our researchers. We were going to people's homes. We knew that many of them had mental problems. Many of them had problems with alcohol. Many of them had used or currently used drugs. Many of them had a violent background, and some of them had been in prison. We wanted to make sure that it's safe. And we were going to interview them about the topic that's going to cause them stress. So we wanted to make sure that making this research is safe for our researchers. There were always two interviewers. We never went alone, except that one case that I told. But there were always two of us. And it was not only a question of safety, it was also practical reasons. Our coordinator, who was sitting here in Jyväskylä, she took all the phone calls, talked with these participants, voluntary participants, and she was kind of the first people they told their story to. She didn't ask for that, but people wanted to tell her. So her job was quite heavy, actually. And she set the date and made the travel plan, and then we, as researchers, we just traveled and met these informants usually at their own homes. But we were thinking there were difference between researchers in our project about the question how much you should know about the informant. Like our coordinator, Johanna, she knew so much about these people because she talked with all of them via phone. Sometimes they were really long phone calls, and they told like main points of their life story, or sometimes very detailed life story for her first. And in some cases, for example, my colleague Pekka, he always wanted to know as much as possible. So she asked, and Johanna told as much as Johanna knew. Johanna told Pekka before we went. When I didn't want to know that much, it was necessary to know basic things, like what we knew about how old the participant is and what kind of background she or he might have. But I didn't want to know too much. Like, for example, we did, together with Pekka, we did one interview in Helsinki prison in Sörnäinen. And Johanna contacted the prisoner, and she also contacted the prison's psychiatrist, who recommended for this man to participate. And Johanna, for example, knew why he was there, why he was in prison, what he had done. He had quite a long sentence. That's all I know. Pekka wanted to know all, and Johanna told for Pekka, but I said that I don't want to know why this man is in prison. I don't want to know too much about him before I will meet him. And I think it was good for my mental health to meet him with less prejudices, maybe. He didn't want to talk about it either. By the interview, by the way, he cut his life story to that date when he was sent to Sörnäinen prison. So I didn't ask. I thought it was good that I didn't know too much about him. And one point about safety in our project, our coordinator Johanna, she always knew, because she was the one who set the interviews timetables, so she always knew where we were and the address, the phone numbers, and what time we are there, so that if something would have happened, we didn't know. Some of the participants were quite aggressive via phone, and therefore, if we were not certain that it would be safe, we also made this interview in some public place, like in libraries or in a town official, wherever we could rent a room. So it was more safe place than to go home for someone's home who is very aggressive via phone and who we don't know anything about. Different from all the other research projects that I have participated before this, we had to make social media strategy beforehand. We agreed together because we didn't know what was going to. We were a little. We didn't know what was going to happen when we were starting the project in summer 2014. So we agreed that we don't add these people to our social media contacts. We don't give our phone numbers for them, our personal phone numbers. Of course, I had to give my work phone number because I'm working at the university and it's a public job in a way. And not to give our personal contact information, any kind of contact information. I was moving house during the project, and at the same time, it was easy to make my address and phone number secret to ex-directory because, we met lots of people with difficulties in their life and I couldn't be sure about them. It was sometimes also difficult. We had this very professional role in these interviews. We were not supposed to make friends with these people. We were not supposed to make them our Facebook friends even. We were doing our work, and they knew that, and no one even asked me to be their Facebook friends. But it wasn't always easy. I made over 100 interviews. Of course, I met people that I immediately clicked. I knew that they were like soulmates, and I knew we could be friends in different circumstances. But then I just decided that it has to wait until the project ends, because this is really important project, and I can't risk my job for this. So I didn't contact these informants in any other context except for the research. This is relevant, I think, in a topic like this. But of course, if you are making the research from something a little less difficult, with a little easier topic, of course it's different. Of course you can be friends with your informants. But I think it's good to think about it and not to take it self-evident. I think you don't have to be friends with your informants in any case. You can put a line. Well, now we have prepared a project, and now we are actually going to the interviews and making a project. Oh, it seems that 1 hour is not going to be enough for me. Again, start from the interviewee and interviewee's viewpoint. As I said also earlier, interviewee has a right to withdraw from the project also in the middle of an interview. I know I'm repeating myself. This is very important. Another very important point is that we were researchers of history and ethnology and social work. We were not therapists. There is a difference between a therapeutic discussion and a research discussion or research interview. There's obvious differences, and we should not play therapists. However, for our participants, this discussion often had a kind of, they were therapeutic experiences for them, but it was not our job to work as therapists. We had no permits for that, and it could have been caused a lot of trouble. But actually, one researcher in our project had an education for a therapist, so sometimes sometimes she handled some of these situations, but it would have been very wrong, for example, me to start give advice for people with special mental problems. That was not our job. I said that it was important to tell for participants that they can have breaks and they can interrupt interview whenever they wanted, and we always said that it's also interviewers might want to have a break. Well, that never occurred, but it turned out to be very important that they knew that they can have a break, these informants, that they can have a break. Many of them cried, wanted to have a break, to cry a little. First time in my life I've been making interviews where a participant wants to take some medical help to continue, or have just coffee break, or just go outside for a cigarette to be able to continue. And then there's the question of alcohol. And I'm addressing a question here. What if participant or interviewee is not capable to talk, or it seems that he or she doesn't know that what the research is about or where he or she is participating? This not capable to talk is, of course, I'm referring here to alcohol. Researchers who made the similar inquiry in Sweden, they were educating us, training us for this job, and they warned us that there might be people who are drunk or taking drugs or or medication when you are going to do the interview, because they are not able to talk about it without it. And so we talk about this, we prepared ourselves, and we decided that a little bit of alcohol is not wrong, but if informant is so messed up that he or she doesn't know really who we are or what he's talking or she is talking about, then we have to just cut it and leave and come back later if it's okay. But luckily, this never happened. Only once we had to leave the place and not to do the interview, and that was not reason for alcohol, but actually this old lady was just too. She didn't know who we were. I had just talked to her day before, but she was too old. I think she might have Alzheimer's disease or something. But she just asked, "Oh, what researchers you are?" And then we realized that we can't continue because she's not responsible on what she's talking about. So we just talked with her a little while and then we left. But many of the informants did take alcohol during the interview. Some of them a little more than others. Sometimes when we went to someone's home, I could smell from the breath of the participant that there's been some alcohol before we came. He's been drinking. But as long as they knew what they were doing and they were talking clearly and thinking clearly, at least they seemed to think clearly, then we said that it's okay, we don't mind. And I think often the alcohol was needed only for encouragement to be able to talk about such a difficult topic. Well, during the project, you have to think about a few things from the viewpoint of the material. These are very practical things and kind of tips. For example, we always had two recorders. I don't know, maybe this is, again, one self-evident thing, but I didn't think about this before. When I was doing other interviews, I've always had only one recorder. But now we always had two, because the interviews were so intense, we were so focused, that you couldn't see if the battery was ending or something went wrong with the other recorder. So we had kind of like safe copy. And it was important, because sometimes one of the recorders had shut down in the middle of and no one noticed. And these are interviews you can't repeat. You can't ask them to tell about things again. As I said, there were always two researchers. One of us was making notes, taking care of the recorders, and sitting like there in the back. And then the other one was focusing on the interviewee and making this, conducting the interview. And it was very good because, as I said, they were really intense interviews, and it would have been impossible to make notes at the same time. However, it was important that we made some notes. After each interview in the evening, when we were in a hotel room or wherever, we made safe copies of the material, so that the material was always in two places, not just on a one memory stick or one computer. And now we come to one practical thing that was new in our project. Ministry wanted these materials to be treated in a very extra carefully, because all these interviews included so sensitive topics and personal details that should not go to public. So our IT... Our IT help desk made computers for us that were protected with double passwords, and they were also protected in a way that you actually were not able to go to internet in any case, in any situation with those computers. So where they were useless to anything else but to make notes for these interviews. Which was difficult because you have to carry two computers on your fieldwork because you need one for your emails. But these project computers were totally only for making notes and making safe copies. Also, these I don't know what they are called in English, these huge, not memory sticks, but larger ones. They were also protected with passwords and made to connection to our project computers so that these memory sticks, when you were not able to open them except in one computer. So that if a memory stick where the safe copies of the interviews were, if it would have been lost or stealed, it would be useless for anyone because it's only able, you're only open to able it on one computer, or actually two computers. And this turned out to be very important, though during long field work trips when I had to carry all this safe equipment, I was a little frustrated of why this has to be so. But it turned out to be very important. We didn't forget computers to train or bus or taxis or hotel rooms. But turned out that we had this project room here at the university, and there was a robber there. There's this one fellow who goes around our campus and steals things from open rooms. And even though our room was locked, he managed to go in and took one of the computers, our phone, and one of these memory sticks. But we didn't get the computer back, but he's not good enough to open the coding, extra coding there. So I was so happy we had safe, really like super password, double password the computer, and there was no harm done for this robbery. But it gave us a lesson that you actually have to think about the safety of the material from this very practical viewpoint too. If you are having a topic where it would be a disaster if the material would go to wrong hands. While making the research or making an interview, from the viewpoint of researcher, there's again lots of things to ponder. Again, I'm repeating myself, but it's important to remember that even in the middle of an interview, when you are in very empathy towards the interviewee and you are really in the middle of his or her life story and traumatic experiences, you again have to remember that you are not a therapist, except if you have, of course, education. And as I said, we had to think about the question of safety when memories we were interviewing about were really fragile and caused stress. As I said, there were two researchers for each of the interview, just for question of safety, to go in some people's strangers' homes where we didn't know what to expect, with people with violent backgrounds, etc. If the informant seemed aggressive in the phone before the interview, if we couldn't set the interview in the public library or somewhere, public place, we sometimes send to male researchers. Because for some reason, gender matters in question of threat and aggressive behavior. As I said, our project coordinator knew the time and place of each of the interview, and after each interview, she waited for us to call her or send SMS to say that, okay, we left now, it's okay. And this we did this also when we had some interviews in the evening, but she just said that she can't go to bed or rest until she knows that we are okay. And even though when the project continued for some time, it turned out to be a little bit careful for this, but I think it was okay, and it became a habit that you have to call for Johanna after each interview. And I think it was very good also to, because she knew she had talking phone with every our informant, so she knew who we were going to meet, and she often wanted to just know how it was, how it went. As I said, we had to have a social media strategy. But it didn't mean only the fact that we had to balance with this Facebook friendship with these informants, but also about where we were traveling and what we were writing. I've been blogging since 2006, I think, and when I was making my PhD dissertation, I used to write to my blog a lot about my work and how I felt, and it was really difficult for me for suddenly to stop writing about my job. But our professor said that recommended that I shouldn't write, because in the beginning we didn't know what was going to happen. Actually, I haven't been writing much about this later now either. And also that we avoid making like Facebook posts like, hey, here, now I am here in this very small village for work making interviews, because we didn't want to in any way to make announced that where we were and what we were doing. So the less the better, active in social media considering the work. We also had to address the question how to find motivation to continue when sometimes it was very, very difficult to do the job. These interviews, this information we learned from the history of our welfare state, it was difficult to handle. It caused us stress and anxiety. And this was all in the middle of the project. We had to find motivation to wake up in the morning and continue and make another research. Also, these fieldwork trips were quite heavy too. But this had been pondered beforehand too, and we, in our project budget, there was a possibility to talk for a professional supervisor, which in Finnish is called työnohjaus. There's no equivalent English term, at least I don't know. But anyway, we had a chance to talk for someone professional about the anxiety the work caused. And of course, because we were employed at the university, we had this occupational doctor services, and we had a chance to meet a doctor and get to be able to talk for occupational psychologist. A very important thing was also that we made these interviews in pairs, because right after when we left someone's home, that was the moment when you most needed someone to talk to, and it was good that there were this other one, and we usually had just a few words that how do you feel, what do you think about, right after the interview. But it turned out to be that sometimes it was a risk to talk about. For example, we were leaving someone's home, we were driving, going to a bus and to a railway station or something, and we shouldn't have talked about it in bus or any public place. Well, nothing happened, but we just learned that there might be someone listening. But about this professional help and occupational psychologist, at the moment I'm working with grant, which means that with Apuraha, that means that I'm not employed at the university but being like independent researcher. I don't have a chance for occupational psychologist at the moment. What if I would be doing research on any research topic sensitive as this, or anything that would cause stress on me, who could I talk to? Or if we have students who want to, often students want to make their master theses on difficult topics, but who can they talk to if the research topic causes stress? And I think this is important to think about, and I've been wanting to talk about this in public after this project, that there should be a system for all the researchers to find help. Okay, now I have like 5 minutes or something. I will finish the project from three different viewpoints. From the viewpoint of an interviewee, the ending of each interview, but also the end of the whole project is important. As I said, these traumatic memories and telling and narrating about these traumatic memories can cause a stress reaction, and most of the people we interviewed didn't expect that to happen, but it did. And it's really important to understand that you can't just leave the room after you have made your interview. this is important part of research ethics. You just can't go and take your interview and then leave and forget them. We talk about this possible stress reaction with the informants beforehand, before the interview started. We tried to make sure if some stress reaction seemed to come, we said them, tried to make sure that there's someone they can talk to, someone to call to, or their family's presence or something, so that they wouldn't be alone on the following night when the nightmares will probably come. For all of them, we gave a list of local crisis centers of the Finnish Association for Mental Health and this phone number of crisis telephone number, where to call to. We also assisted some of them to find information about these peer support groups, and this was the case, for example, especially with victims of sexual abuse. These people didn't always have internet connection at their home, and they knew that there could be some support group they could go to, but they didn't know where to find it and how to go there. And we found the information and gave it them as, and kind of really encouraged them to find help. Two or three weeks after each interview, we called them just to make a simple question: how are you doing now? How have you been doing since our interview? How do you think about the interview now, after 2 weeks? It gave them chance to add something if they wanted to, because, well, that's how memory works. You always remember more things after the recorder is shut down. So they had a chance to add things or, again, ask questions about the practicalities and about the aims of the project, etc., or just to talk to someone, which turned out to be very important too. They just needed someone to talk to. Also, it's been important. It turned out that it's very important for many of them to know that their participation matters. So they wanted to know about the results. Many of them wanted to know about the results. They wanted to know what's going to happen next. So that's why ministry sent the final report, printed copy of the final report for all the participants. And many of them called us when they got it. And also ministry arranged this before it was given for media in April, on the day before. There was this closed publication event for all these interviewees where it was we gave them the report and they had a chance to talk about it and see what's going to happen. It was very difficult event, and I don't want to go to that now, but anyway, it was important that they were the first to know the results. And then in the following morning, it was given for the media. From the viewpoint of research material, after the project ends, it has to be reported in public, of course. What's the point to make research that you don't talk to anyone? The material had to be transcribed. Anonymization had to be done for both the records, the tapes, and transcriptions. And it has to be archived, as I said. When put on an archive, you can set the rules, how who can read the material. And it's important in the case of a sensitive topic, it's important that it goes only for research purposes and not, for example, for journalists or media or just any normal citizen who's curious about the history. And this was a rule that was very important for our interviewees too, that it's not going to be for just anyone in public. It's only for research purposes, and professional researchers are bound with ethical rules, as I said in the beginning. However, at this phase, we have seen we have found out this questions of anonymization, that it's actually quite difficult. We have promised for these interviewees that all the names will be removed from the transcriptions and from the tapes actually too, and that their birth year will not be exact birth year, but like in 5 years, a scale or something. But if all the names, names of people, names of institutions, names of places are removed, what is there left for analysis? And this is no question I don't have answer to. I can't answer to that. But I think this is the reason why it should be pondered before the project starts and not now, when you can actually, well, as historians would be really angry for if they could only get a transcription of an interview where there's no places, no names, no actually nothing left. Only these experiences of violence, which you can't contextualize if you don't have any names in the material. So these questions of anonymization are really, really complicated and not self-evident, and that's why we need to discuss about them with the archive, because they are professional for this in the archives, at least they should be. And then finally, from the viewpoint of researchers, after the project ends, well, as I said, the project ended in spring. My job ended at the end of May. Well, I'm still here talking about it. The project continues in my life. Every week I do something connected to this project. But a sensitive topic like this, it's not... it can be difficult to handle during the project, but it can continue in your life afterwards too. And now I'm not talking only for myself, but for some other researchers in our research group too. How can you, when the project ends, how can you return to a normal life, normal in the way that the life without this project, if the project changed the way you look at the world, like permanently? In this case, well, in my case, the project continues to be part of my life because there's all the time something connected to that. I've been teaching about the project and we've been making new research grant proposals and so on. And I hope to continue research with this topic. But it certainly changed the way I've lived in a very... very safe childhood in very happy family, and I never knew that such a violent actions could. I didn't know children could be treated in a way that I learned in past 2 years, and I think this changed my life, my view of the world, in a way that it's never going to be same again. I'm not going to be naive in the world anymore again. Also, we've been really handling a lot of questions about responsibility. Jelena said how you made this ethnographic film and you will go there back on your field and discuss with them. Well, we can't do that, but I think it's important that we make our results public and we talk about them and try to keep this child welfare things in discussion, in public discussion, to make it matter, to make it sure that these 300 people who participated didn't participate in vain, that it really matters that they told us their stories. I've been thinking a lot, should I contact a few of the informants? As I said, some of them were people that I would really like to make friends. I think we would be quite good friends. But so far, I haven't dared. I don't know if I'm ever going to call one or two of them. But let's see. There's going to be political actions. I don't think I'm ever going to be part of any project that will make such a difference in our society as this did. At the moment, they are making new plans for our social and welfare systems, and our report was read in the parliament and in the ministry, and they have changed things. At least they promised to change things, and they have put more money on the out-of-home care system development. But I don't know if it's going to work anything. But at least I know that something has happened. There's been a discussion that should these people be paid for financial compensation. They paid in Sweden. They are still in the process. And there's a small minority in our interviewees who want to be paid money. And some of the members of the parliament are, together with them, they are working on this and making, writing about it and keeping the topic in public. And that's why there's been another book recently published about the topic, not by our researchers, but another researchers from the Oulu University, and they very publicly claim that they want these financial compensations to be paid. But because we were working for the ministry, our role was really restricted. We couldn't say anything about the financial compensations because we were not free. Ministry was the one who paid for us, and ministry said that this is, you don't discuss about this, so we didn't. But now we are in the middle of this old storm, and now we are just thinking that when can we take a stand, should we talk about it, can we make a stand, can we talk about this, can we do something to do for these political actions, or do we even want to? Is it our role, or should we not participate in politics? What's the role of a researcher? To conclude, to start conclusion with the questions I said in the beginning, how should research ethics take into consideration when the topic and the interviewee are fragile and vulnerable, and what does it mean that the research topics is difficult or sensitive? Well, my case study here is just one example, and I think you can find lots of other examples. For example, I think Laura knows that too, that, for example, asylum seekers are one of the groups that are really vulnerable and really fragile, and making research with asylum seekers is something you have to think very carefully. But there's other groups too, and they are not always this dramatic. I know our case study is kind of really like different example. But however, things that I want to repeat and to come up is that it doesn't have to be a sensitive topic, but I think you always have to contact your informant after the interview. Professor of ethnology told me that this was all like self-evident custom in the early days of ethnology, that you always did that. You always contacted the informant a few weeks after the interview. But no one told me when I was studying that you should do this, and I think it's been forgotten. But it doesn't have to be a sensitive topic. But I think it's about respecting your informants, that you call for them later, and it's only like 10 minutes in your work time. Also, participants are, I think they have right to know about the research results. Academic peer-reviewed articles are not necessarily something they want to read if they are not academic, they don't probably understand it. But I totally agree with speakers before me that you should write also other sorts of texts and try to make it sure that these informants read them or are able to read them. As I said, when a topic is sensitive, it demands extra consideration of research ethics. You have to think how the research is done, why is it done, and how it's reported, and what can come after that. And even though research ethics is focused on protecting your informants, I think it's important to protect the researchers too. And this is also something that it's not very much talked about at the university. Only a healthy and well-being researcher can make ethically balanced research. That is my claim, and I've been talking about this a lot since our project, and I will continue talking about it, because I don't think we pay enough attention on the well-being of researcher. I think Yelena didn't mention at all about your own well-being when you are making interviews in slums, but I think it's very important. And then again, something I said, these questions of anonymization are so very difficult that they should be think about. They are not self-evident. You can contact us, any of us. I'm working at the department in the discipline of ethnology. Antti Malinen is also from our department. He's a historian, as well as Johanna Oksanen, whose doctoral, she was our coordinator. And did a huge job in the project. She's making her dissertation in the history. Professor of social work, Mario Kuronen, is still in our faculty. She works here. She was one of the leading professors in our project. And Professor Pire Markkola, she used to be a professor here at the time, but now currently she's working at the University of Tampere, and she was the principal leader of the project. And like the public figure. And I wish you next weekend that you could follow the news. And next Sunday is going to happen something that doesn't happen very often in Western countries, or at least not in Finland. Our state will present the public apology for these children who were abused and neglected in out-of-home care. Our research group will be there, present in Finlandia House in Helsinki, and I don't know what's going to happen, but they will say they're sorry. I don't know what's that going to be enough, but that's what they're going to do. They're going to say that it went wrong, that these children were not treated well. And it's going to be in news. I'm quite certain it's going to be in news. So I hope you see that, because it's quite rare in Finland at least. But thank you. I've already overlapped my time, but as I warned that this could happen. The topic is so close to my heart that I talk long. I could talk longer. But if you have any questions, I'm happy to try to answer at least.
Thank you, Kirsi Maria, for an interesting presentation. Any questions or comments?
Yes. Out of curiosity, could you tell us in a nutshell what you think was the main failings or reason behind these abuses? I mean, was it a political thing, a lack of money issue, or because now the state is apologizing, but what caused all these?
Well, it's difficult to put in a nutshell, but I could say that there were, well, at least two main reasons. Lack of supervision. Foster families or these institutions, they were not supervised. Or if they were supervised, the officer or social worker who went to see the family just had a cup of coffee with the parents or with the head of the children's home and not talk with the kids themselves. So the lack of supervision or inefficient supervision was, I think, one of the main reasons. But then, well, two more reasons. One would be that these children were not believed. If a child tells that I'm not doing well in this family or in this institution, child is often not believed. That's just how our culture works. Children are not think of being like, well, reliable, and then structures of course made it possible that these kind of institutions could be and that these foster families were not supervised properly, or they were not chosen carefully enough. So structural violence is one of the big issues. But it's a very good question, and I think, because it was just a, like, official report, which is only like a scratch from the surface of the material, so we had really little chance to find the answer for question how was it possible. We tried, our historians in our group, they read the newspapers from the time and professional magazines and tried to find out how was the child welfare system supposed to be at that time. But I wished we get funding so we could continue and we could find the answers. How was it possible?
Okay, anything else? Any questions or comments? In case not, I suggest we take a 10-minute break and then continue with the last lecture. So let's say 13 minutes and start at 3 o'clock sharp.
Yeah,
without family. But